Someone mentioned to me, a friend of mine is a book dealer in Connecticut. He said that he had gotten word from Viking last week that, that Working Days is out of stock.
It's we went back for another printing.
Is that right?
We sold out. So new printing's coming in on Tuesday.
Is that right?
Sorry, I didn't tell you.
I was, yeah, I didn't know what to tell him, you know.
We went back about a week ago.
Is that right?
Yeah.
What was the... Is that right?
That's 5,000 copies.
That's terrific.
Oh, yeah. All the attention it's getting.
That's wonderful.
They really moved out of the store.
How many copies in the first run? Do you remember? Do you know?
I can check for you. I don't want to tell you.
Yeah, somebody told me it was around 12 or between 12.
Right.
Yeah,
right. 15, we can check.
I'd be curious to know that. Yeah, that surprised me because some stores I was in. My parents live in Wilton.
Well, some stores will probably still have the book.
Yeah, so New Canaan Bookshop had about 7 of them, but Klein's in Westport, which is certainly the biggest bookstore in Westport, didn't have any.
Oh, really?
And the guy was waving the New York Times, and he said, "I don't know where they are." He said, "I don't know where they are." And I said, "Well," I didn't say anything. I didn't tell him who I was. I was just curious. So I said, "Well, I know a man at Viking. You need to call him." I didn't say that.
Well, distribution has always been a problem in the book industry. When you think about books, you're talking about a relatively archaic means of communication compared to
what we have now.
And video and this sort of thing. And you're talking about having to actually write the book and then proof it, and then it has to be typeset and physically bound
that's
and
true.
It has to be
it
shipped
is.
Out by truck. Or
thank God for it, too. That's is my feeling.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing, too, about books is that they even a book with a small printing has a big influence. I think, obviously, books have... Somebody can... half a nation could be watching a sitcom on ABC, which is the bastion of dumb comedies for television, and they don't have as much influence as a book that might have a printing of 5,000. When you think about it, because these books reach the minds of the people.
Yeah,
they reach the people who count, who actually shape the things we do intellectually.
Right. You should have been a teacher.
No,
I mean,
no, I shouldn't.
That's what I've been saying for 22 years. You know? Why you shouldn't watch television, why you should read books. So thanks for that. That's,
well, you're the teacher, so teach me something about Working Days, the Journals of the Grapes of Wrath. This Grapes of Wrath, of course, is generally considered to be Steinbeck's masterpiece. And you explain a lot about how this book came to be in the Journals of the Grapes of Wrath. What impulse did Steinbeck have to write the Grapes of Wrath?
Well, I think he clearly had a very strong sense of partisanship toward the condition, the very bleak and almost inhumane condition of the migrant workers in California from about 1936 to 1938, close to 1939. So I think his primary impulse was a humanitarian. He had a series of experiences that took place that he invested a great deal of his own time and emotion in that in a way kind of bonded him to the whole plight of the migrant worker in California in the late 30s. I think that was the essential impulse. What happened, of course, was that he didn't realize that impulse the first three times around that he attempted to write down what he knew about the migrant workers. It was only the fourth attempt, which was, in fact, the novel, The Grapes of Wrath, as we know it, the novel that we actually have now, that he was able to realize that sense of coming to grips with the tragic dimensions of the migrant workers' plight in the ironic situation of being in the lushest and most productive agricultural valleys in the world, and yet themselves either starving, literally starving to death, or not having a place to live, or not even having a subsistence wage to be able to work and retain their whatever shred of dignity they had left.
Now, in Working Days, I believe you say that he had, and you may have just mentioned that he had a couple of false starts. Didn't he start a book called The Oklahomans and another one called something?
L'Affaire Lettuceburg.
Yes.
Probably the unwieldiest title ever concocted by an American writer. And so, thank God, Steinbeck burned that one. I mean, we don't know if he burned it, but he destroyed it. Yeah, he started with actually his first engagement with what I took to loosely call in the introduction of the book, The Matter of the Migrants. the first engagement with that material was a series of investigative reports that Steinbeck wrote for the San Francisco News, which was at that time probably the only progressive or pro-labor newspaper in the state of California. He did a good deal of field research in the summer of 1936 and produced these very hard-hitting, clearly realized, and very focused series of seven articles on the conditions of the migrants in California at that time, with a special attention taken with what were called the migrant, the government camps that were being set up by the Farm Security Administration for the succor, if you will, of the migrant conditions, a place where they could be, could find some haven from the difficulties of the economic and social situation that they encountered, which, by the way, was extremely hostile in California when they crossed the border and came into that state looking for work among in the agricultural valleys. With that set of reports, Steinbeck established a certain amount of credibility as a reporter, as an investigative researcher into the actual unsentimentalized conditions of the workers in California. For the next couple of years, he was able to draw on that journalistic experience as a kind of fund, a sort of a reservoir of knowledge, experience, direct, what we would call now sort of hands-on knowledge of the conditions that the workers, the migrants worked under. And also, of course, it gave him a set of introductions to people in the Farm Security Administration who would remain extremely generous over the next couple of years with their time, with their energy, and so on, in helping Steinbeck meet migrants and sort of get on the inside, see that situation from the inside. After he did that series of articles called The Harvest Gypsies, which appeared in October of 1936, he then decided he wanted to write a novel. And sometime in 1937, he began what was he later called The Oklahomans. And that manuscript has never survived. We've not seen it. We do have some of Steinbeck's own comments about it. And apparently it focused on the migration of the Oklahoma, of the farmers from Dust Bowl, Oklahoma to California, the emphasis being their desire to get a piece of land of their own. That's all we know about that particular draft. Steinbeck apparently didn't finish it. My own feeling is, my hunch is that he probably felt it was something like he was writing something like a Wagons West romance and decided that this wouldn't quite do, wouldn't be quite hard-hitting enough to do justice to the dimensions of the migrant situation, which by 1937 and into 1938 was really heating up, becoming much more of a celebrated cause and much more of a controversy among conservative and progressive citizens in the state of California. He apparently then dropped The Oklahomans and then started in on a third version of this migrant material, another novel, which he titled L'Affaire Lettuceburg, very unwieldy title. That novel was named so because the town that Steinbeck grew up in as a child in California was Salinas, and Salinas was at the time, and may still be, known as the salad capital of the world, the lettuce capital of the world. It's one of the greatest producers of lettuce in the entire on the entire planet. Steinbeck had witnessed in 1936 a very, very vicious strike of lettuce workers against corporate farm owners. The strike failed because it was put down with real terrorism, vigilantism, beatings, whippings, all kinds of intimidation. And so that the workers' cause in that particular situation was quelled. Steinbeck was appalled by that. And so he, in this third stage of this, of writing of this material about the migrants, he decided he would write a vicious and vituperative satire of the vigilante mentality in the ways it had worked itself out in putting down the strike of unionizing farm workers. What happened was that it was a manuscript after he had written 70,000 words on it, had finished it, he destroyed it. He refused to send it to his agents. And I think what probably happened was that he felt that that satire, which would of course naturally have to be, have a certain comedic quality about it, probably trivialized the increasingly tragic implications of the workers' plight in California. And he also felt in a very long letter, he expressed in a very long letter to his agent, Pat Covici, who was at that time his editor at the Viking Press, he expressed to Covici that it also was a trivialization of his own talent. And so he felt the entire thing was something he would have to abandon. He did it, but he did it with a clear conscience because he felt that a good deal of the poison that he had built up in him against the Associated Farmers, against the conservative factions, the allied conservative factions of the newspapers and the media and the banks and so on, which all of which seemed, in Steinbeck's mind at least, to have organized as vigilantism, he felt that that poison was exorcised. He had kind of gotten rid of it. He destroyed Lafaire Lettisburg about the middle of May 1938, and then within about 10 days, at the most, a week to 10 days, he sat down and began to write The Grapes of Wrath, a novel that we now have, the one that we know, and kept with that novel for roughly 100 days until the end of October when he finally finished it. So the Grapes of Wrath really is like Whitman's Leaves of Grass. It has a fairly long and complicated foreground.
Yes, but isn't there a published forerunner of Grapes of Wrath in Dubious Battle?
Well, yes and no. In Dubious Battle was the first novel that Steinbeck wrote which took for its subject a doomed agricultural, failed agricultural strike in California. And from that point of view, the material had something to do with striking workers. It did not have anything to do with the journey of the migrants from the Dust Bowl to California. And also, the tone of the of In Dubious Battle is extremely dispassionate. I mean, Steinbeck as an author, in fact, he said in a letter to someone, he said that in writing In Dubious Battle, he wanted to give no hint of any authorial morality, any author's point of view, any sense of morality toward either the strikers on the one hand or the farm owners on the other. So it is a very dispassionate and very objective and very removed novel. And in that regard, it's very much unlike Grapes of Wrath. And the difference, I think, is that something happened to Steinbeck in the, I think, especially in February and March of 1938. He saw something that changed him so much that it accounted for the impassioned quality of The Grapes of Wrath. I mean, here was a novel finally from a writer who had been essentially a traditional third-person objective reporter. All of a sudden he has an experience that places him into an arena that he had never been in before, and that arena was one where a great deal of compassion was issued forth from him. And gave that novel, gave The Grapes of Wrath, a kind of rhythm and a kind of passionate intensity and engagement that none of his other fiction to that point had had.
Now, Steinbeck began work on The Grapes of Wrath. He kept a journal. Tell me about this journal, because you have put this journal together and very heavily annotated in this book, Working Days.
Well, Steinbeck liked to work. He was like an athlete. He liked to warm up each day before he started whatever the writing task was at hand. And oftentimes, he kept ledgers when he wrote of Mice and Men, for instance, and some of the stories of the Long Valley. They're sort of disparate. They're not an entirety. And then he would abandon them. He'd get tired of them, and he would abandon them. Or he would start each day by writing two or three or four, sometimes five or six letters to either friends or to his agent or to his publisher at the time. This time, when he wrote The Grapes of Wrath, I think he decided he was going to try to keep a diary for the whole stretch. No cheating, no doing it for, you know, one day out of five or do it for a month and then quit. He decided he... he would try to keep the journal as long as he was writing a novel. And I think it not only warmed him up, but it gave him some way of talking back to or resisting the enormous numbers of intrusions that he had coming into his life every day. We tend to forget that before The Grapes of Wrath was published, Steinbeck was already famous, and I say especially with In Dubious Battle, of course, but even more than that, the notoriety that he got from Of Mice and Men, which was published as a novel in 1937 and then ran for over 200 shows on Broadway in the winter of 1937 and won the New York Drama Critics Circle Award that year. With that one book, Steinbeck was a hot property. He was a hot literary property. And so every day he would get mail, he would get telephone calls, he would get cables, he would get people coming to his door, all of whom wanted something. They wanted him to lend his name to a cause. They wanted him to send money to them. He got a lot of requests from strangers who just said, send me $100 because then I can get to sunny California and get a job. I mean, all the kinds of things that he ultimately found, really, really very sad and tragic, and he had very little way of defending himself against. And I think that the journal came out of that sense of needing to complain to somebody somewhere, so that we find him complaining about some of the intrusions that are taking place in his life. But we also find him talking to himself in the way that any good athlete or anybody who requires intense concentration for their work would talk to themselves, to get themselves ready, get themselves into a state of concentrated intensity for the work that's at hand.
Has the journal shed light on any difficulties he had in drafting this book?
Well, yes and no. I think it tells us more about how he handled the enormous, even inordinate number of daily intrusions.
A lot of it seems to be like a list of, we had drinks with so-and-so, this couple stopped in when
yes,
I had dinner.
Right. There are a lot of what we might even consider to be sort of esoteric references.
Because there's a later journal he did when he was writing East of Eden.
Yes.
That I read.
It's much different. They're much different. When he did the East of Eden Journal, I think was much more relaxed, and the entries are much more philosophical, or they're deeper reaching, they're more elaborate. Here in the Grapes of Wrath Journal, there's an impassioned sort of intensity. There's a sense that if he doesn't get this work done within the 5 months he allotted himself, he'll never get it done. So they're full of all kinds of things. Including things like famous people coming to visit him, Broderick Crawford and Charlie Chaplin and a number of others who would disrupt his workday and so on, although that was generally willingly so.
But the journal isn't really quite complete. It doesn't really lead up to the end of the writing of The Grapes of Wrath, does it?
Yes, it does. It covers all the days that he actually wrote the novel. It begins in late May of 1938 when he had already written probably about two pages, and it goes right to October 26th, which was the day that he literally wrote the very last word of the novel.
What date was that?
October 26th. Yeah, October 26th. I think that's entry number 99 in the journal itself.
Here it is.
It's 93.
But he doesn't actually say it's finished, it's over.
It's done. I think this is part of the general sense of his not realizing what it was he had produced. I mean, he was the journal is full of obviously overall the triumph of having completed this 200,000 word novel in 99 or so working days, but it also is there's a resonant chord that runs through it all the time, and that is Steinbeck complaining that he said I'm just not up to finishing his novel. I just don't have the talent that's necessary to do it. And this is an astonishing irony, because here was a man not only writing at the absolute top of his form as a novelist, but also producing one of the monumental novels of of 20th century American literature, and no one, and least of all himself, could convince him that he was doing a great novel. So at the end, the very, very last entry, he is worried about the fact that he may be in for a siege of the flu, and he doesn't know whether to hold off and go to bed and try to get better and then come back to the novel, or just go ahead and try to finish. And so he muddles through the very last part of the novel, about the last 700 words or so, and his whole comment on it, I find this wonderfully understated and ironic, I suppose, finish this day and I hope to God it's good. You know, that sort of sums up his sense of what he had done. Not you know, finish today and, you know, my God, it's a great novel, but still prayerful, still hopeful that it might be okay, even okay.
Well, he finished this manuscript. Then what happened? Did he have to go back and rewrite it, or what?
No, he didn't rewrite it. What happened was that, again, I said a little bit earlier, a couple minutes ago, that here was a case of a novelist literally writing at the top of his form. So much so that the number of cross-outs and emendations and wrong starts, false starts, if you will, on the manuscript of the novel itself are nearly non-existent. I mean, this again is just a remarkable testimony to the moment of Steinbeck's inspiration.
Have you seen the original manuscript?
Yes, I have. Yeah,
it's clean.
Extremely clean. Yeah, he wrote in a ledger book, 18-inch long ledger book by 12 inches wide, and he was able, because his handwriting was so tiny, he was able to get as many as 1,300 words on a single ledger page, and that helped him. I think it sort of underscored or undergirded the sense of intensity that he wanted for that novel. And everything was compacted and held together by the force of his will, as it were.
Well, obviously he wrote it in his head before he put it.
I think he did. I think he did.
Most writers play with the words and go back.
Right.
And
that's
move
right.
Paragraphs
right.
And
that's right.
Chapters.
There's none of that. There's absolutely none of that in this book, in the manuscript. I mean, now there were changes made, and most of them were minor. They were changes in terms of diction. Some words were changed. The most famous episode, of course, concerns the removal of about a dozen instances of four-letter words. And some of the other changes also occur on the galley pages, the galley proofs of the when the novel was set up in print. But as I say, these are mostly in regard to diction, changes of a word here and there. The novel, as it's published, is almost exactly as Steinbeck wrote it. I mean, in terms of its larger shape, in terms of its paragraphing, in terms of its arrangement of chapters and so on. So it really is an astonishing moment of literary creativity on the part of a writer who, as I say, was not only on the top of his form, but managed somehow to habitate in the world of those characters every single day, almost every single day, for a period of 5 months.
Now, there was a controversy regarding the conclusion of the book, in which Rose of Sharon offers her breast to a starving stranger. Tell me about that, and how was this resolved or not resolved?
Well, the controversy still goes on. I mean, it may be. I mean, many people have said that it is among the most controversial endings in the history of American fiction. I think that's probably true. There were two views of it, however. One view was that that Steinbeck had simply tacked that ending on as a way to titillate his audience and to get out of the book, you know, to close the book. Working on the journal, however, I discovered that, in fact, Steinbeck began the novel with that last scene in mind. Where that scene came from is open to some discussion. My feeling was, and this was borne out by a number of other people who had worked on Steinbeck for a while, that it was an episode that Steinbeck witnessed at Visalia, California, in the winter of 1938. And it was an experience that was recorded by a number of very famous photographs by a man named Horace Bristol, who was a fairly well-known documentary photographer at the time. That seemed to be a plausible source for that final ending. But recently, Steinbeck's biographer, Jackson Benson, in a new book on Steinbeck, has suggested that Steinbeck got the story of a woman giving her breast to a much older man from a hobo in a hobo camp south of San Francisco in the 1920s, at one of those moments when Steinbeck was on the lam, as it were, from his formal study at Stanford and was out tramping around the countryside. And Steinbeck apparently told that man, whoever it was, I mean, he remains nameless to us now, told that man that, A, it was a fascinating story, and B, he paid him for it, by the way, gave him some money, and he said, I can use that someday. So that again is another possibility. No matter where he got it, the point was that the novel was envisioned from the very beginning on Steinbeck's part with that last scene of Rose of Sharon saving that starving man in a physical gesture, of course, that opened out to become an enormously symbolic one as well.
And despite Covici's request, Steinbeck insisted that it be.
Yeah, Steinbeck was adamant about that final scene. He resisted every attempt by his editor, and then of course by everyone else, critics especially, to soften that scene in any way or to feel guilty about it. I mean, many critics really attacked him for that scene, and he just refused to feel guilty about it.
How did the title come about?
The title came about, it's from Julia Ward Howe's Battle Hymn of the Republic. And the title, a famous song, the novel that Steinbeck was writing was actually unnamed from May until September of 1938. And Carol, his wife, his first wife, was typing the manuscript. And she would type furiously to try to keep up with his writing. And one night in early September of 1938, she suggested to him that the title should be The Grapes of Wrath. And when she did that, Steinbeck immediately thought it was a brilliant title, and he wrote in the journal, and then later told a couple of friends of his in letters, that he said the novel has being at last. Once it was said, I think that title is absolutely fabulous. So the title really came from Carol. She was the one who provided it.
What happened after the book was published? Apparently, I can almost see Viking saying instant bestseller, but it wasn't it?
It was, yes it was. I think there were, in fact, three pre-publication printings, I believe, before it was officially published on April 14th of 1939. Again, Steinbeck felt so unsure about the novel, he felt that he knew it was powerful, he knew it wouldn't pull any punches, but he did not feel that it would be a popular book. So he warned Viking Press, and he warned his agent as well, not to oversell it, because he just didn't think it was the kind of book most Americans would care to read. And again, of course, it turned out to be utterly wrong. It was an instant bestseller, and it occasioned the most incredible kinds of controversy over the verisimilitude of the workers' conditions in California. And Steinbeck suffered a great deal for a year or so, maybe even a little more, because he kept being attacked by what he called official California, by the conservative press and by the representatives of the Associated Farmers and so on, what we would now call the agribusiness concerns or corporate farming, something like that. He suffered a great deal at their repeated attacks on the verisimilitude and the legitimacy of the novel. But in fact, one thing in particular vindicated him, and that was the La Follette Commission inquiries into the labor practices in California. And when that commission was done with its findings, it enthusiastically vindicated Steinbeck's portrait of the trials and tribulations of the Okies in California. In fact, I've heard from other people, people who I talked to had served on the La Follette Commission or known people had, the secret feeling was that Steinbeck had actually played down had toned down how bad the situation actually was among the migrants in California.
But there was a partisan reaction to the book too, wasn't it? Branded as a communist book.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it was hailed from the floor of the Senate as a vile, one of the vilest books ever written by an American. But yeah, it was seen as, on the other hand, I mean, Stennett couldn't win in this, but it was one of those novels that he simply couldn't win on. Either the Associated Farmers attacked him because they felt that he had blown the conditions for migrants all out of proportion, members of the left would attack him because he either was not communist enough, or members of the liberal press would attack him because he was too communistic. I mean, it was one of those books that somehow touched a nerve in everybody who read it, and Steinbeck could never quite please all of them, let alone one group at a time.
Didn't it launch the FBI to begin keeping a file on the?
Yes, it did. One of the great ironies, of course, is that Steinbeck wrote to a friend of his and said, the Associated Farmers are after me, and I'm going to turn all this information over to J. Edgar Hoover, and he'll protect me. Well, what Steinbeck didn't realize was that J. Edgar Hoover had already branded him one of the leading dissidents in the West, and had started a file on him that the FBI, in fact, continued, I think, until about 1964, 65, just a few years before he died. So it's a novel that just, the effects of which went in every direction in Steinbeck's life. It really, finally, it just made him almost give up writing fiction altogether. It was the notoriety, the controversy over it, the publicity just nearly did him in. He was a man, as many writers have said, he was a man better equipped for failure than he was for success in many ways. He had a difficult time when success came his way, with all of its attendant traps and solicitations and so on.
The very fact that the FBI kept this dossier made it difficult. Didn't he want to enlist in the army?
Yes, he did. He did. He had a great deal of time, a great deal of trouble getting clearance. And of course, as with any bureaucracy, it was one of those situations where, the left hand never seemed to know what the right hand was doing. He could never get a clear answer. He eventually did his duty, so to speak, as a reporter for the New York Herald Tribune, and he covered the European and African front in about 6 months, from about June to December of 1943. And those dispatches were then later published as a collection called Once There Was a War. But yeah, that's right. He had real difficulty getting a commission in the service, which is what he wanted. He was a very patriotic man in many, many ways.
He certainly wasn't a communist.
Not at all. In fact, one of the great ironies about Steinbeck is, of course, he was hailed by the extreme left-wing press as being, the quintessential Marxist writer and so on, even at the expense of the fact that they completely misread In Dubious Battle, which doesn't take a side either way. But one of the astonishing things that I always feel is that Steinbeck was a dyed-in-the-wool American. I mean, he was in the sense that he was an absolute believer in Roosevelt's New Deal policies. And he was. He was, like many other proletarian writers of the time, he was extremely partisan toward and influenced by Roosevelt's policies during that New Deal era. Friends of his, people who worked in the Farm Security Administration in California, who helped open doors for him and helped get his first writings on the migrants published. And then people like Per Lorentz, the great documentary filmmaker, who was from 1938 till about 1940 was head of the United States Film Service, which was a New Deal inspired cinema program to make documentary films that all Americans should see. So Steinbeck was not a communist at all. In fact, the political radical in his family was his wife. Carol had much greater empathy for and leanings toward the left, not the progressive left, but toward Marxist theory and so on, than Steinbeck did. And of course, what happened was that, as I say, Steinbeck was essentially a New Dealer in a lot of ways.
Now, from what you've said, I think that when the book came out, it was seen as a political book or sociological book. How do we see it now? Still that same way, or more as a work of literature?
I think a little bit of both. I just came back about a month ago from an enormous Grapes of Wrath conference at San Jose State University. Went on for about 4 days, and I felt that same sense of bifurcation. It's still going on, that tension between seeing the novel as a piece of fiction which I believe in, which I tried to emphasize in my introduction, that Steinbeck really was writing a novel rather than a political tract. And the other group of critics who I think still see it as a sociological document. My feeling is that to keep seeing the novel as a sociological document places certain emphasis on the book that it simply doesn't have. Let me put it to you another way. It places demands on the novel, on the book, that cannot always be satisfied. To see it as a novel, I think, probably one adopts, perhaps particularly in this age, a more tolerant view toward it. I think that some of the failures and the shortcomings of the book as a novel are more readily acceptable when one sees it as a piece of fiction rather than as a sociological document.
Well, I don't believe.
But that sense of why, I guess if there was any refrain that I heard at that conference last month, particularly among dissenters, it was always that Steinbeck, they were angry because Steinbeck didn't quite write the book they wanted him to write. And my point is, this is the book he wrote. This is the one we have. This is the one he wanted to give us. And that's the one we have to deal with. I mean, that's the one I think that provides a note of reality in all this, you know, that we have to respond to.
Well, I don't think it can be seen as a sociological document because sociological documents aren't read year after year. They don't hold up. The plays of Maxwell Anderson, many of them are just so out of date. And Clifford Odets, I mean, they're interesting from a historical standpoint, but people just don't go to them and enjoy them because they made statements that were appropriate to that period. So I think that Grapes of Wrath transcends the issues of the 1930s and the Dust Bowl and this sort of thing, which is why it's so readable today.
I think so. Absolutely. I mean, I think it's that sense of that. I think I said a while ago that Steinbeck's impulse tended to be, I think was, clearly humanitarian. And that sense of humanity, that sense of the compassion that he felt for those characters, as characters, not as necessarily as historical figures, but as characters, as living, breathing people, in the sense that they inhabit the geography of this novel, gave the book a kind of universality that makes it transcend a simply sociological dimension. And I think too, it was a prophetic book. I think that's one of the wonderful things about The Grapes of Wrath. Prophetic in the sense of witnessing this past year the devastation that's come back to us in the Midwest, in the drought in the Midwest, the foreclosures of small farms again happening, but also the whole notion of homelessness that the novel speaks to, which is now very much a contemporary issue. I mean, as long as there are issues of drought, foreclosure, displacement, erosion, any way you want to talk about it, of human beings and human dignity, whatever it is, Steinbeck's novel speaks to that. And I think, yes, it does have a universality that transcends that time and that place.
Well, Robert DeMott, my last question. Steinbeck won the Nobel Prize, not, I guess, for The Grapes of Wrath as such, but for the body of work, and I understand that there was some outrage among some critics that Steinbeck winning the Nobel Prize. My last question is, did he deserve to win the Nobel Prize?
Well, that's a loaded question. I think he did. Obviously, I would say that. But we're certainly one of them. The amazing thing is that Steinbeck himself felt he didn't. I mean, his first response was that he didn't deserve it. He was always self-deprecating to the end. But, yeah, I mean, people like Arthur Meisner really attacked the decision and so on. But I think in the sense of that the Nobel Prize doesn't necessarily award sophisticated literary achievement, but speaks to something else that the novel does or that writing does, and that is creating a sense of awareness among its readers or speaking to human conditions somehow, then, yeah, I think Steinbeck deserved it, deserved the Grapes of Wrath. You know, I mean, deserved the Nobel Prize for all of his books beyond just The Grapes of Wrath.
Robert DeMott, thank you very much.
Thanks. My pleasure to be here. Thank you.